This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. What do these names have in common? John Kelly, Sully Sullenberg, Gloria Steinem, Alan Dershowitz. Well, they're all going to be speaking at Purdue University Northwest this year. We'll tell you more about that. Also, too, we have some specific comments as well from one of our state representatives who was at a news conference in Indianapolis about a lawsuit that's been filed involving some actions involving alleged against Attorney General Curtis Hill. And Tammy Silverman from the Indiana Youth Institute joins us with the latest data on the 2019 Kids Count Data Book. Once again, Purdue University Northwest is going to bring in for the next series of Sinai Forum speakers starting this fall some very notable people, people we know every day from the news, in particular in the political world, it turns out. And to tell us more about it, we have the executive director of the Sinai Forum, Leslie Plesak. Leslie, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Chris. I always enjoy talking to you, and I'm really excited about the season that we just announced this past Monday.
That's right. There's some great speakers that are going to be coming to Northwest Indiana in particular, to not only the Northwest Indiana campus at Westville, but also around the region, too, because I know you have to one venue that you're going to have to move around to be able to get enough seats to be able to accommodate all these people that are going to want to listen to the first speaker in particular. Everything starts out September 8th with a former White House Chief of Staff, General John Kelly. First, tell us how you were able to luckily get hold of him and have him come to be the first speaker of the series.
Yeah, so I do want to thank Blue Chip Casino Hotel and Spa because, as you mentioned, they are providing their venue for us to host General Kelly on September 8th for our opening program. We did that last year with James Comey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we choose speakers. People often ask me, how do you make selections? And especially in the political world, in this divisive political climate that we're in, we are a nonpartisan organization. And so we look at everybody, and I love getting feedback and I love getting ideas from our subscribers and talk to people all the time. But General Kelly is a person who we felt can really take an honest look at the geopolitical landscape and talk to us about how it's ever changing. If you look at not just this current administration, but how fast things change in the world. So he is going to be giving us his perspective on where we are geopolitically. And we looked at a number of different speakers. And General Kelly, he has the experience, obviously, as a retired four-star general. He has the experience as the former Secretary of Homeland Security and, of course, his most recent experience in the Trump administration. And we just felt that he was he's a great speaker. And we felt that he was a great, just a good person to open. And I know there are, some people like him, some people don't. The beauty of the Sinai Forum is that we bring people together in dialogue, in conversation. He's doing, a 30-minute Q&A after his presentation. And it's an opportunity to listen and learn. That's really what the forum is about.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the general speaks, coming up later on October 6th, it shows, I guess, the diversity of speakers that you have. You have Liz Murray coming in, and I understand that her talk is titled From Homeless to Harvard. That's a very interesting transition.
Right, right. So Liz Murray's story, I often ask people, who's the best speaker you ever saw? And I was talking to someone who books speakers in West Lafayette, and she told me that Liz Murray was among the best that she'd ever heard. Mm-hmm. Liz Murray's story, as you mentioned, is from homeless to Harvard, and there was a Lifetime movie made out of her story, and she has a book out called Breaking Night. And Breaking Night refers to when you're in the homeless community. She actually was 15 years old after both of her parents had passed away. They were loving parents but addicted to drugs, and she found herself homeless. And she mentions, I'm reading her book right now, that she was kind of going from friend's house to friend's house, and the first time she went to a friend's house and the friend's parents wouldn't allow her to stay, she slept on the subway in New York, and she realized that she was homeless. But she also realized that her mom had died with a bunch of unrealized dreams, and she made a decision that she was going to go to high school. She finished high school in 2 years, and she received a full scholarship from the New York Times to Harvard University, and she has gone on to do amazing things in her life, and now she is the executive director and co-founder of an organization called the Arthur Project, which is a mentoring program that works with high-risk middle school youth. So her story is one that will inspire you and also, I think, just make us kind of have a perspective on what it's like to be young like that and beat the odds, really. I mean, it's very, her ability to triumph over adversity is pretty amazing.
Wow, what an interesting speaker she will be, definitely, to be sure. As well, the one following Liz Murray, that's coming up on October 27th. Alan Dershowitz is scheduled to be another in the speaker in the next Sinai Forum series. Tell us about Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, he'll be speaking on Sunday, October 27th, and all the programs take place on Sunday afternoon. Alan Dershowitz, the title of his talk is called Perspectives on Justice and Civil Liberties. And Dershowitz is probably one of the, I would say, most a prominent scholar on U.S. constitutional and criminal law. And if you watch any of the political news now, you know that he makes a lot of appearances. And I think his latest book is called The Case Against Impeaching Trump. And again, your personal politics aside, it will be a discussion about how we as a nation are often moving to trying people in the court of public opinion as opposed to really following the laws, which is, you know, something that we want to be careful about. So he will, you know, probably he's a if you've ever seen him speak, he's very academic, but he's also humorous. And I think it will be a really interesting discussion, thought provoking discussion on what it means to be a civil libertarian in this, you know, in this day and age. So Alan Dershowitz will join us, as you mentioned, on Sunday, October 27th.
Now, coming up in November, there is one speaker that's on the Sinai Forum's speaker schedule. That's going to be on Sunday, November 10th. It's Captain Sully Sullenberger. And his talk is entitled 208 Seconds, A Lifetime of Lessons. We know this man from his example that he is no doubt set for many, many people in the aviation industry these days.
Right, exactly. And I would say, as I'm out speaking about the forum, he probably has the most recognizable face in our lineup. People are excited to hear Captain Sullenberger speak. He is known for The Miracle on the Hudson, and of course there was a movie made where Tom Hanks played Sully, and it was produced by Clint Eastwood. But really what he's going to talk about is his lifetime of experience that allowed him to stay calm. I read it was an op-ed that he wrote in the Washington Post recently, and he said the number one question he gets asked is how did he stay calm in that circumstance? And he will be talking about that experience. And he noted that as a leader, as the captain of that plane, had he gotten, you know, had he lost his ability to stay calm, that may have turned out very differently. So he's going to draw on his personal experience. He's also an expert in safety aviation. And in light of all that's going on, you know, with Boeing and air safety, I think it's very relevant. So I think he will be delightful, you know, interesting speaker on some, you know, serious subjects, but also how they relate to our everyday lives.
Now, coming up, the last of the series for this year, coming up on December 1st, it's entitled An Afternoon with Gloria Steinem, another great speaker that, along with all the others, will, I'm certainly, enlighten and entertain whoever shows up.
Right. So Gloria Steinem is probably well, she certainly is one of the most iconic figures in the women's movement. And a lot of people, you know, think of Gloria Steinem and they think of feminism, but Gloria Steinem is much more than that. She's certainly, you know, was the co-founder of Ms. Magazine, and she has several books that she's written. But to me, she is an opportunity for women, for young women, for men, too, to really look at how this gender transition and how we're moving towards equality. And, you know, with everything that's going on again in our climate today, I think this is an opportunity to hear Gloria Steinem tell her story. She is a very, she's an advocate for equality in all ways. I mean, she, I was talking to my daughters, they're 26 and 23, and both of them knew of Gloria Steinem, but they didn't really know so much about her progression. And so I've encouraged both of them to be there on December 1st.
That's right.
To hear her and learn. It's the reason why young women today can do any of the things that they want to do. It's all of the women before us, you know, that have sort of paved the way. And I mean, Gloria Steinem was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I mean, that's the highest civilian honor. And, you know, she's in her early 80s. And so I think she belongs on the roster of speakers when you look at it historically for people who have changed the way we view the world. So Gloria Steinem, I'm super excited to hear her speak.
And I know that for sure there will be some limited tickets available for the first in the series. That's with General Kelly coming up on September 8th when he speaks over the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City. But you're encouraging season tickets so that anybody can attend all of the Sinai Forum speeches coming up through the series this time around.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I have to tell you, Chris, tickets are selling so quickly. So if people are interested, the series, it's sold as a series. So the number one question I get is, can I buy a single program ticket? Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, the only single program ticket we have available because of the generosity of Blue Chip Space is for General John Kelly. And you can go to our website, which we can give that information, but you can see the single program ticket there. The other thing is, if a person is interested in hearing just one speaker, you do have the option of coming to our venue, which is the Dworkin Center on the Westville campus of Purdue Northwest, the day of the program. And if we have an empty seat, we make that available to people, but we can't guarantee it. So it's kind of, you know, you're taking a chance. But otherwise, the very best way is to secure your season series tickets as soon as possible, because they are selling really, really fast. I mean, truly, they really are.
Now, how do you get the season tickets or the opportunity, at least in the first speech with General Kelly, to be able to pick up that single ticket?
So the best way to do it is go to our website, which is PNW for Purdue Northwest, pnw.edu, and then it's /Sinai-Forum. Or if you do a search for Sinai Forum, that should come up. And on the page, we have an FAQ tab, which is frequently asked questions. And we also have our season ticket tab. So either of those will give you the ticket information. And one thing I do want to point out, which is amazing and always has been in the whole 66-year history of the Forum, is that students, both high school and college students with a valid student ID, are allowed to attend the programs free of charge. They are asked to make an RSVP for the General Kelly program, and that information is also on our website under the ticket information. And they are welcome at any of the programs at the DSEC with their valid ID, no reservation required. But we are going to be super tight. We're going to be full this year. So, you know, we might be needing a bigger venue eventually.
Wow. Well, Leslie, this is a great series coming this year for 2019, starting this fall with the speakers for the Sinai Forum. Some great speakers that are on the list for this time around. Every year is pretty good, but this year is one of these really good years that you can hardly miss out on. And it's well worth the cost of a season ticket to be sure to attend all of these conference speakers as they come in on Sunday afternoons at 4 o'clock. They're either for the first one coming up here with General Kelly there at the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, but the rest, of course, on the Purdue University Northwest campus in Westville. Thank you, Leslie, for all the information and the best of luck. And we hope that there are at least a few seats left for somebody to be able to attend some of these all through the season.
Yeah, there's plenty of tickets available. I really appreciate the opportunity to share the season. We're super excited and encourage people to join us for the 66th season of the Sinai Forum. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Leslie Plezak is Executive Director of the Sinai Forum, which is based at Purdue University Northwest in Westville. Indiana's Attorney General is being sued in federal court by four women who say he drunkenly groped them during a party last year. The women and their attorneys announced the lawsuit against Republican State Attorney General Curtis Hill at a news conference today. The women's lawyer said back in October that they intended to sue Hill after a special prosecutor declined to pursue criminal charges against him. State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon from Munster is one of those involved, and she answered reporters' questions about whether the women have suffered because of what happened.
I would say yes. I think that you cannot go through something as traumatic and as this and not have it affect your life. It changes the way you view the world. It changes the way you do your job. It's become a distraction to doing our jobs. It's certainly influenced where we go and where we don't go. You know, it's caused distress to our families, to our friends. You know, it's impacted our health. There's a whole host of unintended consequences that go along with this kind of trauma. So yes, we have felt unsafe, and it changes the way you view the world. and the way we interact with people.
As for threatening behavior, she talks about that. And the other voice that you'll hear in this excerpt, by the way, is attorney Hannah Kaufman Joseph.
Certainly, there's a lot of commentary on social media about me personally and my integrity. My integrity was impugned. I think that's threatening to my career and to my life. We don't want to be here. We don't want to be here. We didn't want this to happen. We didn't want this circus, but here we are. You know, here we are. And certainly, you know, when you're talking about threatening behavior subsequent to somebody putting their hand down my dress, yes, there has been, you know, certainly times when I feel unsafe.
And I would just add that a number of the victims, including Representative Reardon, have actually had interactions with Curtis Hill and members of his staff in which they have behaved in a threatening manner, being too close in proximity to our clients, engaging in stare downs.
Sure. I am the person whose eyes the bodyguard is on when I'm in the state-funded bodyguard that Curtis Hill enjoys now. I am the one who is stared at and followed throughout the room. I'm the one that he's looking at, and I didn't do anything wrong.
Mara Candelaria Reardon also talked about the current rules in the Indiana General Assembly dealing with sexual harassment, its adequacy, and why the legal action is being taken.
The sexual harassment policy does not address anything but interactions with lawmakers. It does not address constitutional office holders. It does not address this situation specifically. And, you know, when an elected official betrays the trust, the public trust, in such an egregious way so as to commit sexual battery and assault, and doesn't have the honor to resign to maintain the dignity of the office, there have to be consequences for those actions, and there have to be options to hold him accountable. And that's what I believe that this lawsuit does. It's shooting for institutional change. That's what the goal is here, institutional change. And we don't see that in that policy that was adopted. It merely governs legislators and not this situation specifically.
Curtis Hill is accused of touching the backs or buttocks of Representative Reardon and three legislative staffers, all women, in March of 2018 at an Indianapolis bar. Hill has denied wrongdoing, and he has rebuffed calls from Governor Eric Holcomb to resign. He faces an October hearing on possible sanctions from the Indiana State Supreme Court, which could include up to disbarment as an attorney. Our thanks to Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brenton Smith for the comments from today's news conference. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Sometimes I feel like I'm in the middle of two worlds, four worlds, and sometimes I feel like I'm not a part of any of them, which is difficult. Before I came out, I was at a party. And I was talking to this girl. She's like, I understand gay people. Like, that's fine. Like, if you're a man and you want to date a man, like, that's fine. And I understand straight people because, like, you know. But, like, there's probably just something wrong with bi people, you know. Like, something has to be, like, messed up in their heads. And I was, like, in the closet at this point. Like, I knew that I was bi. And I was just, like, sort of standing by. And I was like, okay, yeah. No, just like people they just make up these ideas in their head about what being bi is and how other people feel about how those people must feel about it. And it's really screwed up because I think it's sort of a weird place to be in and a hard place to be in most of the time because people just don't quite get it. And I think largely people are starting to sort of accept gay people more and there's still stigma against bi people or surrounding bi people. Because people just don't quite get it. I don't know why. I feel like I have the opportunity to understand a lot of different perspectives. And I think that makes me a less ignorant individual. It makes me a more intelligent individual. It makes me a more open individual on all fronts. So I think being biracial, I am really able to embrace two cultures. And I think that's awesome. People who can't embrace more than one culture or don't want to or don't have the opportunity, I think they miss out. there's so much there. There's so much that is important in both of the cultures that I am really grateful that I can just like wholeheartedly embrace both of them. Most of the time I see myself as a bridge between and amongst people. When I was first coming out, I was talking to two of my friends who are gay, and they said, you shouldn't come out because you feel like you have to teach people something. You should come out because you want to and you feel comfortable doing that, and that's who you want to be and show people that you are that person. And I think that's really important. When I think that I still feel a lot of pressure to show people or tell people about the different worlds that I sort of occupy so that they can learn. I want them to learn.
We used to live at Hunters Point, and they told me, I lived there for 3 years and paid my rent, and they told me they were not going to resign my lease. So I had to find another place to move to, and Housing Opportunity told me I could move into their apartments. When I had to move out of Hunters Point, I had 30 days, and I had no extra money for U-Haul and security deposits. So I stayed with my aunt for a couple of days, and she wasn't very nice, you know, because no people was living in her house. My aunt was kind of selfish. You know, we couldn't eat her groceries. And I couldn't use her shower because she said it cost money to take showers. So my aunt was kind of rough. Because I think because they have everything what they need, and they don't realize when you don't have nothing and they have everything, it's kind of like, you know, a burden on them, you know, because they have to help you out. Those couple of times I didn't think I was taking enough responsibilities, because I had to ask for my family to help me. And then there were times when I'm like, that's why you're supposed to have your families to help you. So my family can be ugly at times. And, you know, my daughter had, Monica had her whole back surgery, and she was in ICU. They didn't think she was gonna make it through. And I didn't have no family though. She wasn't coming out of the anesthesia, and they didn't know why. Finally came out of it. I did that on my own. That makes you strong. Sometimes I have meltdowns, and sometimes I, you know, say, okay, you know, and go on. It was hard about being homeless, because you don't know where you're going to go to lay down at night. You don't know when your next meal is coming in. And, you know, I didn't know how to go get diapers and wipes for my daughter, because she's, you know, wheelchair bound. And it's scary. You just don't know what you want to do. It's awful feeling. So when they told me I got the apartment, I was so sad. I could take a shower when I wanted to. I could, you know, I didn't have no furniture. I had no TV. I had nothing. But I don't care. I had my freedom. I can take a shower. I can make my hot dogs. You know, whatever I wanted. I just look at my daughter and smile. And I just do it for her. I think people who are negative, they are sad in their life. They have to make everybody else sad. So you just have to be happy. She's a lot of work, but she's my baby girl.
And you can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're supported by listeners like you. The Kids Count Data Book is now the 30th edition that has come out from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. For 2019, how does Indiana rank? Well, let's find out. Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, and she is with us now from Indianapolis to fill us in. Tammy, as always, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, we know that the overall goal is to get some really serious and valuable insight into what progress we're making as far as our young people's well-being here in Indiana, and where you've got to do some more work ahead. How do we stand from the latest data that's come out on how Indiana ranks this year, and some of the points that we have to improve on, and some of the high points, I guess, some improvements we've noted?
Certainly. Well, this year we came in at 29th in the country for child well-being, which is, you know, needs a little context. What they do is they look at a whole bunch of indicators from every state across the country in the areas of health, family and community, economic well-being, and education. So when you break that down, in many of those areas, we made some slight improvements. However, overall, we still dropped one spot from last year. Last year, we were 28th. This year, we're 29th. And so what kind of the big takeaway from that is we did make some improvements in several areas, but it also seems as though perhaps some other states were making more advances a little bit faster than we were.
So we were moving ahead, but we weren't moving quite as fast as some states were, apparently.
Correct. Well,
where do we seem to be showing, first off, the improvements compared to last year?
Well, a couple of our big improvements is that for the first time in several years, we saw the number of Hoosier children living in poverty decrease. And so that's a really positive indicator because, you know, when a household has some more resources, kids get more preventative medical care. They perhaps have more investments in their education or their after-school programs, that kind of a thing. And so most parents, you know, if they do have those resources, want to meet all their needs. But if those financial resources aren't in the house, there's not a lot they can do. So that was a really positive indicator. You know, I think the other thing that is perhaps the biggest takeaway bright spot, and I don't know if you want me to reveal that early on or hang on to it because it was a big one, is that Indiana actually tied with five other states for the lowest rate of teen substance abuse in the country.
That's great. That's good to hear.
Yes, we were a little surprised by that, actually, because, you know, we're so focused on adult substance use disorder that we thought probably it was a big issue with teens as well. And it's not to say we don't need to pay attention to it, but we are tied for the lowest rate in the country.
Now, I know that the data probably does not bear it out exactly, but if you, working with the IYI, get to see it on a more regular basis. Where do you think that the improvement came from? Are we getting better education out there for young people not to be using this stuff to begin with?
There is some better education. There's better interventions, right, so that if a teen did start using, they're more likely to stop than they have been in the past. So some of those intervention programs as well as the prevention programs, they both seem to be working because we're at just 3% of our teens are using illegal substances right now. So we need to, you know, again, that's something that we can't really let our foot off the gas on. You know, it doesn't mean we're done and we need to stop those programs. We still need to pay attention. And there is a bit of a cautionary tale because the number of teens using nicotine, which is a separate category, has been increasing.
Yeah,
so we
I
need to keep paying attention to that.
There's a very serious concern about e-cigarettes and vaping in particular. That's why I know a lot of school corporations are starting to crack down on that, to be sure.
You're
That's
absolutely
all.
Right.
Well, let me take a look here about health, and let's take a look at education. How did we rank in the latest Kids Count book on how Indiana youngsters are doing on their education?
Well, in education, we came in 21st in the country this year. In the last year, we were ranked 14th. So again, this is one of those areas, and yet it remains our strongest area. We backslid a little compared to other states. That being said, we did actually get better on the number of young children, 3 and 4, that are in school. We got better on the 4th grade proficiency levels in reading and the 8th grade proficiency levels in math, which are all strong indicators of long-term success. So positive, positive, positive. The one area that we were surprised by that we haven't seen in several years is the number of high school students who did not graduate on time mm-hmm. actually went up for the first time in a good number of years.
I see. How much of an increase did we see year to year over that?
It was just 2%, but the trends have been, you know, had been going in the right direction for almost a decade.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute about the latest Kids Count data book that is out from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. How did Indiana rank? Well, we're finding out here. I know that the family and community is another one of the areas that the Annie E. Casey Foundation looks closely at when they put all the data together. How did Indiana rank in that span?
Family and communities, unfortunately, was our lowest rank at 32. Mm-hmm. Again, we got better in some of the big bucket indicators, and that's even that household education levels, the number of kids living in poverty, teen births remains at an all-time low. All of those things we got better at. Unfortunately, I think the rest of the country was getting better as well and perhaps got better a little bit faster than we are.
Mm-hmm. I know that you noted in the report, looking at the executive summary, that there is some serious racial disparities that are out there in the national data as far as African-American children, Latino children, their families, and all of the factors that build into that. How did we rank in that as far as Indiana is concerned?
Well, that's where we still need to keep making sure, and we break down almost all of these indicators, if the data is available, by race, because, you know, particularly if you're talking about health, right, the number of children that low birth weight babies is an area we still have a challenge in infant mortality rates. And if you break that down, the number of black babies who don't reach their first birthday is significantly higher than children of other races. We also look at, you know, when they're, those high family household costs are much higher in African-American families and Latino families as a percent of their total income. So again, we need to make sure we're disaggregating the data, because while the indicators may have a slight improvement when you look at kids overall, we need to make sure at each and every Hoosier child, regardless of race, place, or income, do have the resources and the opportunities to reach their full potential.
Now, I know we've talked about this before when we take a look at the data every year, it seems, from the Kids Count data book, and I know that that's give you an opportunity, with you and your colleagues there at the IYI, to spend the rest of the year now in trying to figure out how to improve the programs or create the programs to help deal with some of these issues that are still out there. You have an opportunity very soon to be able to not only go over the data, but to be able to share it with some of the other organizations out there so they can help out?
Absolutely. The data is all right available. In fact, there's a link right on the front of our website, which is IYI.org, so mm-hmm. anyone can access the data. But, Chris, you're absolutely right. So, for example, when we talked about the on-time high school graduation rates, that is something we are going to be diving deeper in to see really what is the cause of that, and also having follow-up conversations, be that with the Department of Education, the Commission on Higher Ed, individual school districts, to say, what does this mean, and what are we going to do about this, right? We want to make sure that all of our teens are graduating from high school and have a post-secondary pathway. So that was a little bit of a surprise, and it's up to us to really dive in and say, what now? What else do we need to do? What actions do we need to take?
Yeah. Have you had an opportunity, knowing what this data is going to might be most likely look like because it's coming out, how programs coming into the summer months for the IYI are doing?
Yes, I think we have seen that, you know, again, these are all areas, particularly that educators and after-school providers are really in excited about, to say, you know, we are making improvements. So how do we keep moving forward? How do we keep these programs continuing perhaps to serve more kids or serve the kids that they are more deeply? And so, again, the data is a starting point. It's certainly not an end point, but it's something that we need to pay attention to make sure that we're allocating our time and resources to the best outcome.
Well, Tammy, thank you for sharing the data, the latest information from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for us here in the Kids Count data book and how it's going to pertain to Indiana. And we'll get to see how these programs shape up in the months ahead. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Always my pleasure. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome. Tammy Silverman's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Remember those financial resolutions we made here after the 1st of January? Well, it's now halfway through the year. Since we have June in full swing, we're getting to the midway point of the year, and maybe time to see if those financial goals seem to be matching up with your current lifestyle. Well, for that, let's turn to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer for a little review and take out that checklist and see how things are looking there. Greg, thanks for being with us, and let's jump right in. What are some of the 5 points we need to take a look at here at the middle of the year?
Well, I think the first place to start for most people is, check your retirement contributions. You know, I always tell people, first and foremost, you should at least be taking advantage of any type of employer match that might be available to you. I always tell people it's free money. You don't want to leave that on the table at all. But ideally, hopefully, you know, you aim for maxing out your tax-favored retirement plans that not only might include the 401k, but, you know, different contributions to, say, like a Roth or maybe some college plans, things that you need to do to help build your future and your nest egg and take care of some of the financial hurdles that you have.
Mm-hmm. How about the question about debt? We all always need to look at that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, debt's always one of those evils, right? It's out there. Most people battle it to some degree. I think today in the modern era of credit cards, it's easy to kind of fall into the trap because it's easy access to that availability of funds. But with the rising interest rate, and it has kind of stalled a little bit with the interest rates, but they're still historically low. So taking advantage to pay down some of those balances before those rates start to climb. If you don't, it could absolutely cripple your budget because, you know, as interest rates rise, the minimum payments become higher, and it's harder and harder to tackle some of that debt.
Mm-hmm. I know that we always advise people that they should, and we hear from other advisors too, about making sure that you've got between 3 and 6 months worth of living expenses backed up there on that rainy day fund. But I understand that may not be enough. You should have more. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think that this is probably one of the easiest things to overlook as an individual, as a family. When things happen unexpectedly, that's generally what spirals financial disaster. Usually if we don't have that type of money, something happens, it's not just being laid off of work or having a job change. It's, you know, the car breaks down, the roof leaks, you know, things that come up in everyday life that are those unexpected expenses. And if you don't have money put aside, then you end up using the credit cards. And also if you do end up in a situation where, you know, income changes or, you know, we have a job change, whatever it might be, without that reserve, you know, it's hard to build a strategy to recover from, you know, sudden life change.
Mm-hmm. I know, too, that to keep an eye on your spending as much as you possibly can, but I guess there are sometimes that maybe we panic a bit more because things aren't changing like they should. How should we be able to keep better track of our spending?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, in monitoring your spending is kind of look at where your debt level was 6 months ago when you looked at it in January and see where it's going. You know, are you gaining? Are you breaking even kind of? Is it getting worse? And, you know, when you begin to look at it from a high level, then it's time to sit down and look at your actual budget. I always have told people a good exercise. I'm not a big budget fan, but it is a good exercise to create a budget to kind of see where your expenses are going. And I think even more so, Chris, just write down everywhere you spend money mm-hmm. in a notebook for 30 to 60 days and really try to identify where the money is going. And if at the end of the day, you know, I always tell people it's about two things, what's coming in and what's going out. If what's going out is more than what's coming in, you have to make some hard decisions, you know, about what you're doing currently and what you're spending money on, and it might require some lifestyle changes. Either that or you might seriously consider, hey, the career I'm in, maybe I need to look at a different type of career or look at creating additional income. But that's really the A and B of the equation that you just need to get a grip on.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people have had an opportunity here, especially in keeping track of their expenses, and you say some of their lifestyle moves. Maybe some people have had to make changes. Not to say that the cable people like to hear about this, but people have cut the cable, literally. They've gone to other services to get their entertainment rather than cable television because it's gotten so expensive for them. And I know that's one way that you can keep track of your finances, too. And we don't always talk about taxes, except it seems like around income tax filing time, but it might not be a bad idea to review them here by the end of the year.
Yeah, well, and you've heard me say this before. I think there's two things when it comes to just taxes in general. You know, if you come in to get your taxes done during tax season, it's all about preparation. There can be no planning. We can't undo what was done in the previous year. It's more about, you know, let's put the input in and see how it turned out. So preparation is one thing, but planning, I think, is paramount when it comes to getting a handle on your taxes and understanding what the liability is before you go to file your taxes and trying to, you know, have an accurate target or an idea of what that liability might be. And then second, I think, you know, what's really kind of unique in the situation we are with the tax law change, I believe this is one of the best tax planning opportunities that people could potentially have and since I've been in the business. Because, you know, previously, especially with two working families, you know, there was not a lot of room to work within the tax brackets. And now with the new laws in place, there's opportunity to consider things like Roth conversion that simply did not exist before this tax law change. And, you know, having an understanding of those tax laws and having your advisor work in connection with your tax advisor could provide some great opportunities to create tax efficiencies, tax savings, you know, just tax planning opportunities.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer, and we know that you've been in your business, no doubt you talk to a lot of millennials, a lot of Gen Xers and all, and probably they get a chance to take a look at how their finances are doing and seeing how they can compare themselves with their father's generation. And sometimes a father doesn't always know best, does he?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we get both examples when it comes to our parents, our fathers, our mothers. You know, you get the example on the side, hey, this is a good role model. You get the example, maybe this is not the way, You know, I want to see my retirement unfold. And, you know, it's both sides of the equation for different people, but just understanding spending, you know, one of the things my father was always very, very diligent on, he goes, you know, he never even owned a credit card. He never, he always wanted to pay cash, always wanted to pay in time, was just phenomenal in not getting into debt. But, you know, it's a good example, it's a good principle to teach. Whether your father was good at it or not, it's still a principle that's taught. And devising a plan around understanding that example can help avoid either the trap or, you know, follow down the same path that was very effective for your father.
Do you think, too, that maybe for older Americans, they've seen, looking back at their fathers who may or may not properly plan for retirement, that maybe they were kind of headed down the wrong road, and so you're hoping that your youngsters or your grandkids don't follow suit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, realistically, most families today, I think, are very much paycheck to paycheck, and you know, as you have opportunities to maybe change that situation, maybe there's an increase in income or a bonus, a raise, whatever it might be, a job change. You know, often we find ourselves with that lifestyle creep. You know, we have a situation where, you know, the discretionary income rises and we find a way to put it in part of our budget and spend the money. And while that deservedly so, you should do some of that, I think it's very significant and important to at least take some portion of that and, you know, either go towards debt reduction or go towards savings. I always tell people, pay yourself first. You know, pay yourself first and then improve that situation long term while still enjoying it in the moment.
Well, Greg, it's always great to hear some advice here and to think back about how things have happened in the past and what not to do in the future. And we are glad we have an opportunity to chat with you to get some of this upcoming advice. Certainly for listeners that may in turn have questions, they can, of course, always check in with their own financial advisor. But it's nice to give us get the overall view from the big picture. Thanks for being with us, Greg, and hope to have you back on again soon.
Thanks, Chris.
We've been talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Governor Eric Holcomb made the announcement of the STEM Team Award winners this time around, and one of them is a native of Lake County, in fact, attending Munster High School. Annie Ostojic is one of the winners for the 2019 Governor's STEM Team Awards, the ceremony held in the governor's office not long ago to honor those winners. And Annie is with us here on Regionally Speaking. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, take a minute, tell us a little bit about the STEM team itself, what the purpose of it is. We know pretty much what STEM refers to, of course, but maybe people don't understand about what a teamwork is all about. Tell us about that.
So the Governor's STEM team is something that used to be the Miss and Mr. Science of Indiana, where they used to only pick like two students from the entire state. But now when they have this team effort for a STEM team, it really shows more camaraderie and how there is so much collaboration involved in the STEM field. So now there's a student pick for each category of STEM, for science, technology, engineering, and math. I was specifically picked for the science category. And it's really nice that the governor welcomes us into his office. We talk with different members of the Indiana Department of Ed and just other members of his staff. And it's a very nice event. It's just a great event just to meet all those people in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in the process of STEM, which of course refers to science, technology, engineering, and math?
I've always really had an interest in STEM ever since I was young. When I was younger, I really always have said I was born with goggles and a beaker in hand because I really have liked science for many years. When I was like in kindergarten, I would, for show and tell time, I would show my rock collection to the class. And I really enjoyed like sharing my passion and excitement for STEM. So I started competing when I was about 8 in local science fair competitions. And I've been involved with science ever since. And it's just been a great journey for me. I really enjoyed it.
Do you find that being a young woman who's been interested in the STEM topics, in particular in science, maybe won't say is unusual, but something that maybe you've been able to stand out from among your high school and your grade school colleagues?
Sometimes, for sure. I think that it's nice to see over the years that there's a growing group of different women organizations in STEM that are growing to try and encourage girls to get into STEM. The numbers are lower. I mean, that is true. Like, I can even say, for example, when I took a programming class in C++ at my high school, I was one of three girls in the entire class.
Wow.
So numbers, yeah. So when I was in a group a few years ago that went to internationals from the state science fair, I was one of four girls in that group. So there are certain numbers like that, you know, which is unfortunate. But I think that there are many women groups that really are trying to encourage women to get into the sciences, and I think that that's definitely going to make a difference over time.
Now, I know that you received, among other things, a Letterman jacket during the ceremony there in the governor's office that identifies you as a member of the governor's STEM team. And you've also picked up, too, a $1,000 college scholarship through the Indiana College Choice 529 savings plan. What plans do you have, if you've made them yet or are in the process of making them, to attend college after high school?
Those are both great gifts that were I was very honored to receive with the Governor STEM team awards. But right now, I just finished my junior year. I'll be graduating a semester early, so I'll be done in December.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I take some classes with Purdue and in both math and science. And so right now, I don't know exactly what college I'm going to be at full time. We'll see. But definitely Purdue is a great option. I do want to go into electrical engineering, so that definitely would be a good option for me.
Do you think about starting your classes for your college degree at the Hammond campus or Westville campus and then transferring down to West Lafayette?
I know some students that do that. Yeah, that's definitely something. Especially I've taken some classes at Purdue Northwest at the Hammond campus right now. And I really have had some great instructors there so far, and I've really enjoyed the classes I've been taking there.
Is there any advice that you give to your fellow students and any of the others or other people that have asked questions, since you seem to be one of the few young women who have been really, really interested in the STEM coursework, to get them interested, to let them know that it is important for young women to be involved in science and technology and engineering and math?
The best advice that I would give to those young women is really to accelerate in math early. I was given advice before from people at Purdue in West Lafayette, and I think it was really valuable advice because taking the advanced math classes, because I've been taking math since I completed calculus as a sophomore in high school, and I've been taking math since a higher level, and once you get to a higher level, you can just apply that in so many different areas. Not only, even though, you know, that is the M in STEM, it really is involved in all categories of STEM. And I think that that has made a difference, especially in the research projects that I've done over time. Like recently, after I just completed differential equations and multivariate calculus, I finished the calculus sequence. So there's so many more applications that just opens up so many more opportunities for you. So I would really recommend just to excel in math if you want to get farther in STEM.
Well, Annie, thank you very much for spending time with us to tell us about your studies, about your interest in STEM, how you've done in school, and now, of course, this has led on to becoming one of the newest members of Governor Eric Holcomb's STEM team for 2019 and picking up the award recently from the governor in his office. Thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you very much for having me.
We should also mention, too, that Annie is one of two people from Northwest Indiana who are members of the team. The other member is Carter Goldman. He attends Lake Central High School. This is Regionally Speaking. Leadership at the state's largest teachers union is changing this summer, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us the incoming president says he plans to focus more on local schools' needs.
Keith Gamble has been the Indiana State Teachers Association vice president for 6 years, and later this summer he'll become president after members elected him this spring. He plans to prioritize time in education communities around the state, he says, to keep the union's strategies aligned with what's happening in public schools.
And any modifications that may need to be made from that is done in response to the needs of our members.
ISTA has pressed lawmakers for more public school funding and increases to teacher pay across Indiana, especially during this year's legislative session. Gamble says he wants to highlight the need for better pay for other school employees, too, and improving the state's school funding formula. Gamble takes office August 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
South Bend, a community of members, are looking for answers after the weekend shooting death of a black black man by a police officer. In the Out of Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart has more.
Sergeant Ryan O'Neill shot 53-year-old Eric Logan in the parking lot of Central High Apartments. Officials say O'Neill was responding to a call about someone breaking into cars. Logan was at the scene. O'Neill fired two shots. Logan was transported in a police vehicle to a hospital where he died. O'Neill's body camera was not recording at the time of the incident. No other video evidence has been found. O'Neill is white. He has been placed on administrative leave. An investigation by the St. Joseph County Metro Homicide Unit is ongoing. Prosecutor Ken Cotter says information will continue to be released.
We just want to make sure that this is investigated as well as we can do it.
Those at a vigil Monday night questioned the official version of events. Robert Foltz.
No one really knows the true story yet. You know, and we don't know if it's going to be doctored up or it's going to be told like it is.
A spokesperson with the family says they have information that tells a different story than the official one. They say they will share it in the next few days. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on our program, we have a conversation with Purdue University economist at the main campus to talk about school issues, including property taxes here in Northwest Indiana. Hope you can join us.